Welcome, folks, to episode 3830 of the Survival Podcast. It is Wednesday, April the 8th, 2026. And on most Wednesdays, we have an interview, and today is no different. I will be bringing on our special guest in just a moment. I think I'm saying his name right, because there's two ways you can pronounce a first name, and I didn't ask him, and I meant to. But I think it's Stephen Brass. Some people pronounce Stephen the way he's saying it, Stephen. It depends on who you are. My great uncle had his name spelled that way, and we called him Uncle Stephen. So we'll ask Stephen Stephen when he gets on which one he prefers. Anyway, we're going to talk about, well, I put it in the title, Breaking the Fourth Generation Cycle. This is going from grain to grass with a cattle operation. It's because a fourth generation farmer moving his operation from a grain-fed cattle operation to a grass-fed operation. More and more people are doing that for a variety of reasons. We'll talk to him about how, what, and why. And what that transition's like, because I'm sure it's not easy, folks. I'm sure there's certain things that you really have to think about when you change something in any business, but a business that's been running that long and has been optimized for a certain form of input, changing it to a different form of input, and thereby changing not just the input, but then the output of the product, what it's primarily marketed to, et cetera. This is, you know, we talk about doing stuff like this all the time. It's great when somebody does it, but I don't think that people on the outside looking in saying, well, everybody should do this, really understand what it means to alter a business that way. Because I think we feel like, well, farming's over here and then business is over here. No, it's all business. It's all business. So we're going to be talking about all of this and more, its impact on the earth, even the role Bitcoin is playing in this. And just a moment before we do, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. Sponsor of the day number one today is Biltong USA. That comes from Anton, good friend of the show, also an MSB discount provider, and been a sponsor now for a couple, 3 years. Anton started really marketing Biltong heavily during the COVID years. He had just opened a small grocery store and kind of small little cafe-type restaurant and things like that, and then literally the month he opened, they closed everything down. Biltong was a high market item, it was a high margin item, and he could ship it to people and they would buy it and pay for it. And so he went all in on that. He does other things too, and he does have a physical location store. You can definitely check out the site for some really cool stuff. He's got some smoke salt, for instance. He's just awesome. Imports stuff from all over the world, but the Biltong he makes in-house himself, along with the Drewer sausages, and the Kalabanazi sausages and some other cool stuff. I personally love the Biltong sticks. They're absolutely my favorite snacking item in the world. Full-on carnivore keto, too, man. It's just great stuff. Check them out. Again, the website is BiltongUSA.com. And if you think Biltong is jerky, or somebody told you that, they're jerking you around. It ain't jerky. Biltong is its own thing, and it's pretty awesome. Next up today, CanineAcademy.us. This is Joel Ryle's operation. Joel's another one of our expert council members. He served in that capacity for about 4 years now. He's also a good friend of myself and Dorothy, a good friend of the community, and just an awesome dude. And he raises and trains and delivers some of the best protection dogs in the industry. But the way you train a dog is the way you train a dog. It doesn't matter what you're training them for. The how is the same, and it's built on 3 C's, which is creating a condition where the dog can fail, controlling the condition so that the dog does not fail catastrophically, nothing bad happens, and the minute the failure occurs, correcting it. There's your 3 C's of dog training. Joel will teach you how to do that more. And if you go by Fortress Canine, I'm sorry, canineacademy.us, you can even sign up for a free course to give it all a shot before you spend a dollar of your money. So with that, I want to welcome our special guest, and he can tell us how to pronounce his first name since I blew it and didn't ask him.
Hey, Jack. Yep, you got it right. It's Stephen.
That's what I figured. That's like 99% of the time with that spelling of a name, it's Stephen, but it comes to like an old Greek or something like that, and some do pronounce it Stephen, like my great uncle, who was a really interesting guy, and we'll leave it on that because we're not here to talk about him. We're here to talk about you. And as I said during the intro, you come from a a farming family, a ranching family, been doing this a while, four generations. Mm-hmm. I think you're Gen 4 in this. Mm-hmm. So when you were growing up and all, is that all you ever wanted to do was stay at home, or did you go off and do something else and then come back to the farm? Or how did you end up from like a kid to now where you're running things?
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of my background personally, and then we can transition a little bit into the farm background. I grew up here in Northern Illinois, fourth generation farm. During the 80s, my dad at the time was grain farming with his uncle, and they also had a pig operation. So they had confinement pigs as well. When I was 7 years old, my dad was involved in a farming accident, and it was 2 days before Christmas, and he was cutting a tree down in a fence row, and we had a tractor hooked up to that tree because he wanted it to fall into the field and not the other way. And I was standing by the tractor, and he was cutting that tree, and the tree spun like a top, and it whacked him in the back. And I remember running up there to the tractor, and he just said, "Call the ambulance." So they transported him to the hospital. He ended up being paralyzed from the waist down from that accident. It was 2 days before Christmas when I was 7 years old. So that was, as you can imagine, a difficult season for us, for sure. That next year, my dad was in recovery, a lot of physical therapy and so forth. But at the end of the day, he was still, you know, paralyzed from the waist down. At the time, his uncle, who was in his mid-70s, was kind of took over the operation. At the time, they were doing corn and soybeans, and then they had the pig operation. His uncle, about a year later, ended up having a stroke. So that kind of put his uncle out of the operation. So at that time, my dad, he wasn't one to sit around. He wanted to keep going, you know, keep farming, because that's all he's known his whole life. And he persevered for sure. So he employed a neighbor that was good friends with our family, and they rigged up all of our tractors and our combine so my dad could transfer from his wheelchair onto a seat of the combine, and then they made a lift where he was able to raise up, transfer into the combine and the tractors, and then we put hand controls on all of the tractors and the combine. So we had a lever for the clutch, a lever for the brake. And, he was still able to keep farming. So I was pretty young still at that age, but after his uncle had his stroke, that was really when, you know, my dad, he said, "Hey, we're going to work and I need your help." You know, I was his hands and feet, because he had a vast amount of knowledge. You know, he had mechanical skills, electrical skills. He knew all about grain farming. But he needed somebody that could physically do the work. And that's where I came in. After his uncle had his stroke, my dad had to let go of that hog operation just because it was too demanding, you know, to try to continue to do that. But we still continued to grain farm conventionally. So, I grew up kind of at an early age, helping my dad out for sure on the farm. Transitioned into, graduated from high school. And I always liked working on the farm, doing different things around the farm, but, you know, trying to think long term, well, how could I support a family someday? And I always had a green thumb as well. I always loved flowers. I loved trees. So I ended up after high school going to Iowa State University, and I got a horticulture degree out at Iowa State. Originally, I was thinking I wanted to do greenhouse management. But I did an internship for a semester, and I just realized it was too mundane. It was inside. It was a lot of routine tasks, and I just realized I can't do this forever. So I kind of pivoted gears after college. I ended up getting a tree nursery salesman job with a family nursery, and I was a tree salesman there for a time. I'll back up in high school. I was on a volunteer fire department here in our local town in Stillman Valley here in Northern Illinois. And I've got a long family history of the fire service. My dad, my uncles, my great uncles, my grandpa were all volunteer a fireman on the department. So in high school, I ended up going through the EMT program and kind of their basic firefighter program. And in college, as I was thinking about, you know, career, farming, agriculture, my cousin at the time was a full-time fireman paramedic. And he's like, hey, have you ever thought about testing with departments? And at the time I was like, no, not really. Hmm. So my junior and senior year, just thinking long-term, like, okay, I want to do all these things. What's the best route to go? So I started testing with fire departments. And after I graduated from college, I was working as a tree salesman and ended up getting on a department full-time as a fireman paramedic. And then during that time, my dad and I were still grain farming together. So college, I was coming home from school pretty much every other weekend in the fall to help with harvest. And then, after I graduated, was a tree salesman for a while, and then transitioned into being a fireman paramedic. And then my dad and I continued to grain farm all those years up until about 7 years ago is when my dad ended up passing away. And it was at that point where I had to kind of make a transition as far as, okay, what am I going to do here? Am I going to keep doing the grain side of farming, or do I want to make a pivot? And before that, back in 2010, I've always been concerned with health and nutrition, and I never really liked the grain side of farming because of all the heavy tillage, all the heavy chemicals, all the fertilizers. And so it just, over the years, it just rubbed me wrong that, man, all of this heavy inputs. And at the end of the day, we were producing a product that I never really, you know, felt like we were helping people with.
Yeah.
So 2010, I had started to look into animal agriculture. And it was that point when I kind of dipped my toes in the water and started with cattle. So I'll pause right there and let you keep going.
Yeah, let's talk more about the impetus to switch, because it's not just that you went from like a grain-fed cattle operation to a grass-fed cattle operation, because most cattle are grass-fed for most of their lives anyway. It's finishing that gets mostly done with grain. You went from row cropping grain to grass-grazing cattle. And that had to really have something hit you to make that drastic a change beyond just, hey, this isn't really healthy. And when you were saying that, though, it was making me think about how I've had many people on that grew up and work in what you call farm country. And they're always like, you know, you would think that there'd be farmers markets everywhere around here and that you would go there and there'd be all this amazing different food being produced by all these farms. But we live basically in a food desert full of corn and beans, right? Like, if you want corn and beans, we got that. But the corn and beans you're buying on the shelf, even if they were grown here, probably went somewhere else first and then came back in a product. So we're literally not growing anything locally that we consume locally other than maybe we feed some corn to a pig, right? Like, did you feel that way?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, a little bit of, I think some of the background would be a little bit of context for our farm in particular. My great grandpa originally bought the farm in 1910. And like I said, I'm the fourth generation here. And when I think back to my great grandpa, my grandpa, even my dad, you know, the farming in the U.S. has changed drastically in the last 100 and some years. Yeah. You know, I think back to my great grandpa. It was a diversified farm. They had pigs, they had chickens, they had some dairy cattle, they had beef cattle, they had corn, but they also had alfalfa, oats, and you know, you transition into the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s, and a lot of the universities were promoting efficiency, as you know. Mm-hmm. And well, what does that mean? Well, that means you get rid of the diversity so you can be more efficient at growing from road or, you know, fence row to fence row, tear out the fence row so you can get every last, you know, row of corn that you can. And our farm was no different. My dad went to University of Illinois, and he was an animal science major. And that was what they taught back then. You know, you move the animals off the land onto concrete because it was more efficient. And, that just never sat right with me as far as, man, there's something that we're missing here. And so that was kind of in my background all growing up, that this just, that did not feel right. And so, yeah, I'll pause there again for you.
No, that's good. And, you know, for people that are listening, like, everything he's talking about then went completely parabolic in the 70s. That was the age of go big or go home. And, you know, we did that for a decade, and, you know, 10 years into it, Willie Nelson's doing Farm Aid. And those two things are absolutely connected to each other. So that transitional period, people either adapted to it, went the full kind of organic route, or went out of business. That was pretty much what happened to not all the farms in America, but a lot of them. They either specialized, industrial specialized into a niche, or disappeared. And it was not a great time in the country in a lot of ways for that. I'm just old enough to kind of remember it. When you were transitioning, can you kind of describe that transition from row cropping into like a diverse, rotationally grazed, ecosystemic method of farming? Because I think one thing people really need to get their heads around is you can't go click, right? There mm-hmm. has to be sort of a transition, and like the row cropping's paying so you can keep the farm. So you probably can't go all in all at once. You kind of have to have this transition plan. What's that like?
Yeah. it's difficult in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Originally when we were doing row cropping, it was at that point that our first child was born. My wife and I, our first child was born back in 2010. And there's nothing like, you know, having a new child to think about the future and what do you want your children to inherit? What do you want them to experience? And growing up working on equipment, we were a mid-sized farm. And so we always had equipment that was not new, but it wasn't falling apart either. It was kind of that mid-tier equipment. So
yeah,
there was always something breaking down. And that was so frustrating to me, to be always working on bearings and belts and welding stuff. So at that time, our daughter was born, and, you know, looking more about, okay, what do I want the future to look for our farm? That's when I really started looking at animal agriculture. And I ended up buying 4 cow-calf pairs originally at a sale in 2010. And the breed that I had originally bought were Red Devon. Red Devon was the breed. And for a little bit of history on the breed itself, they were actually the breed that the Pilgrims had brought over in 1623. So they've got a long history in the U.S. And originally the Pilgrims really liked that breed because they were a triple purpose. So they were good at meat production, they were good at milk production, and they could also use them as oxen. And before that time, we had bought a quarter of a cow from some Mennonite friends, and it was grass-fed, and it was the best beef we ever had. And so that's what really kind of, you know, heightened our interest in that breed. And so those were the first cow-calf pairs I bought were 4 cow-calf pairs. Right before that time, I had been talking to my dad a little bit about wanting to start rotationally graze animals. And as you can imagine, he was just shaking his head. He's like, "You're not going to make any money doing that. It's going to be a waste of time." And, I kept on him, and I finally twisted his arm enough to convince him to let me take, it was probably 10 or 15 acres of the worst ground that we had. And I took I took high tensile wire, and I fenced that area in. And, at that time I had subscribed to the Grass Stockman Farmer magazine. I was reading everything I could from Greg Judy and, Joel Salatin, and just trying to figure all of this out. Like, how do you graze animals? How do you rotate animals? And so, you know, those first couple of years, definitely it was a huge learning curve. I was trying to study as much as I could, and I just started doing it. I fenced in areas, I was using poly wire, and I was moving them every day. So I had them here and here and here, and just kind of learning as I went. Like you said, all of our ground here at the farm was all conventionally tilled. So corn, soybean rotation, heavy inputs. And you're right. Going, how do you transition from crop ground into diverse, you know, biology, diverse pastures? And it's a challenge. So the one thing that I kept reading about was, well, you have to have some kind of transition period. And what does that mean? And that means, at least from everything I read, you use annuals to kind of heal the soil, break up the compaction, get the biology going. So that's what I did for the first couple of years.
Yeah.
Was I originally disked the ground that was, you know, corn stubble or soybean stubble.
You have to.
And then, and
for all the people that are no, there is.
Yeah.
You've got compacted ground that's been row cropped for decades. Mm-hmm. If you try to throw down grass seed or like annual forbs and stuff like that, like you're talking about on that, it is going to die. It is not going. You have to begin that process that way. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So that was kind of my game plan, was to start with annuals. And at that same time, I started reading about PA Yeomans and the Yeoman's plow. So I ended up buying 5 Yeoman shanks from Australia and had them shipped here to the farm. And I took an old chisel plow that we weren't using, and I attached those Yeoman plow shanks to the chisel plow. And I ended up ripping, you know, the soil initially to break up some compaction. Then I came back and I disked that ground. And that's when I originally started planting some spring annuals. So I planted cereal rye. Once I grazed that and was done in the spring, then I came back and I planted sorghum Sudan grass and Sudan grass.
Okay.
And I pretty much kept that rotation for at least 2 years till I felt like, hey, I think the biology's going, the soil feels a little bit more mellow. And then after that 2 year period, that's when I actually planted my perennial grass mixture with a bunch of forbs and grass species out there.
You know, when you were mentioning like Joel and Greg, it made me smile because I thought back to a breakfast I had with Greg back in about 2013, 2014 at a permaculture conference. And somebody was there with us. I can't remember who, but they said something about rotational grazing. And they were like, well, surely there's more than one way to do it right. And Greg said, there's a lot more than one way to do it right, but there's a lot more ways to do it wrong than there are to do it right. You're not a lot of like one off the cuff statements that stick with you for more than a decade, but that one did, like, cause I immediately thought that applies to so many freaking things.
Yeah.
There's more than one way to do it right, but there's more wrong ways than right ways. Like, wow. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah. I made tons of mistakes those first few years. You know, you've got a certain amount of animals out there, and my goal was to keep moving them across the pasture and give rest to the pasture. But you get a 1-inch rain, 2-inch rain, and I should have moved them, but instead I was hard nosed. Oh, I got to keep them here for a day. Well, then they packed the ground down and then they tore the sod all up. And so it was definitely a learning curve. The one thing that did help me is I kept really good records. So I had maps of all of my pastures and how many acres they were. And I had how, you know, the density that I had. So did I have a 20 animal units out there? You know, and my density was 50 animal days per acre. So I used all of that, those maps that I had to kind of guide my future. So the next year I'd look back at my maps and I'd be like, ooh, I really grazed that too hard. I need to make a change for this year. So having good records and really just being out on the land every day, deciding, is it too much? Is it too little? Are we seeing improvement? Are we going backwards? That was one thing that really, really helped me out.
Gotcha. What mental shifts did you have to make? I mean, the physical transition is one thing, but I've been through enough stuff with just conventional business where like you just change a directive and you think in your head, this will be easy. And you got to get everybody on board with it. And you got to get yourself remembering that you've done it. You can find yourself kind of pulling back toward what was easy. And you can definitely find yourself maybe thinking about going back because what you're doing is hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you said earlier that it's not something you can just, you could go all in the first year, but you're going to make lots of mistakes. And when you're trying to run a business, that's typically not the best way to do it. So, like I said, I started out with 10 or 15 acres.
Breaking off that manageable square.
Yeah.
And fail small.
Yeah.
And because if you, I don't know how many acres you have in total, but if somebody's got like 1,000 acres and you screw it up all at once, you're going to lose it, right?
Yeah. Our home farm here, is about 150 acres.
Okay.
And at the time when my dad and I were still grain farming, we were renting two other farms, and you know, we were farming several hundred acres together, and you know, starting out with 10 or 15 acres, and then every year or so I would slowly add acreage to my grazing operation. So, you know, the second, third year I added another 5-10 acres, and I kept slowly adding as I felt like my management was getting better, my herd size was growing. But going back to the mental shift, when you live in farm country, whether you know it or not, you know, you're always looking across the fence line at your neighbors, trying to see what are they doing? You know, is there something that we should be doing? Are they planting different, or are they doing no-till? So the mental shift of comparing yourself to your neighbors is a real struggle, whether or not you admit it or not, because let's face it, we're all in agriculture. We all have a community that we're trying to help each other. But when you look at my operation, like it's totally 180 from anything else in the surrounding neighborhood or our county. Like I can think of maybe 3 or 4 other people in our county that are actually rotationally grazing animals, the way I am. So, you know, to look across the fence line and see them doing heavy tillage and planting, especially during those early years when I was learning a lot and I made mistakes, and it's like, oh man, should I just scrap this whole idea and go back to what we knew, even though it wasn't good for the land, it wasn't that profitable. So yeah, the biggest challenge is between your ears for sure.
yeah. You said like I do. So explain what that means as far as, you know, others doing it like you do. Like, what does a day look like moving your cattle around? How frequently, how big of a paddock? You said you got about 150 acres. Is it all converted now? Or are you still partly transitioning? Are you running like one big mob through? Are you breaking into multi-mob and kind of doing it? I mean, it's a pretty big piece of land. So how are you handling all this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after my dad passed away in 2018, that next year I had already bought all of the inputs for growing 2019's crop.
Okay.
And it was really that next year of 2019 that, you know, you don't realize what somebody does until they're gone. Right. And, you know, my dad, he would be running and getting parts while I was working on something else. And he would be in the combine while I was running the grain cart. And so once he was gone, all of that fell on my shoulders. And we had some part-time help that was still helping out. But like I said, you don't realize the impact that somebody has until they're gone. So that next year, it just became pretty obvious to my wife and I that we had to make some kind of transition. We had a young family, 3 kids. I didn't want to be an absentee dad. I was rotationally grazing animals. The beef business, I was expanding that. So I was direct marketing our beef, growing that side of the operation, and then continuing to try to do the grain side. It just became obvious that, you know, we need to make a transition here. So, with lots of prayer and lots of, you know, counsel from some trusted friends, I decided that 2020, like, I just have to step back from the grain side. And so the farms that we were renting, I let go of those leases. I ended up selling most of our equipment, you know, the grain stuff, as far as the combine, our planter, and all that stuff and all that equipment. And it was that year that, our farm here, we still had some acres under conventional tillage. At the time, my herd wasn't large enough to be able to graze all of the farm here. I just didn't have the amount of head. So in the interim, what I did was I turned some of those fields into hay ground, and then I sold hay off of those acres for a couple years until, you know, just to keep some income coming in while I was expanding my beef herd, beef side of the operation. So currently, as we speak, the entire farm is under rotational grazing, and everything is in perennial pastures. Right now I've got probably, 80 to 90 beef animals, And typically that'll swell in the spring because my herd consists of single or year old animals and then 2 year old animals. So the 2 year old animals are the animals that I'm going to be harvesting this upcoming year. So starting in June is kind of when our beef harvest kicks off. So June through the end of the year is when I'm harvesting those 2 year old animals pretty much every 3 to 4 weeks. And then in the springtime, I'll buy in year old animals that I'll add to our 2 year old herd. So I've got one giant herd. And so in another few weeks, I'll end up having anywhere between 150 and 175 animals here on our farm. And, from the start, I've always rotationally grazed. So I've experimented doing between one move per day and 3 moves per day, moving that entire herd. And normally I'll start at the south side of the farm in the springtime and start rotationally grazing. Right now, our animals are still on hay bales right now. We're probably another 2 or 3 weeks away before the grass is between 6 to 8 inches tall, and that's when I'll start our rotation for the year. So in general, I pretty much figure that May 1st is when I can start rotating our animals. So I'll start at a particular spot in the farm, and my plan for this year is to do once a day moves for our animals. So sure. Let's just say all 150 animals are probably going to be on, let's just say an acre, maybe an acre and a half, of ground. And I'm always monitoring the ground. So I'm looking at the grass, and because I'm finishing animals, I don't want them to necessarily eat as low down to the ground as if I had cow calf. Originally I did have cow calf.
Okay.
I had two herds. I had cow calf and I had my finishing herd. So for probably 12 years, I had two herds that I was simultaneously moving and, you know, trying to have a family and do other things. I just realized that I can't do both things well. So
yeah.
that's when I stepped back from the cow calf side. And right now I've got about 4 or 5, producers that are in a local area of our farm that raise calves the way that I want them raised. So no grain, no shots, no antibiotics. They're nursing on the cows until they're between 8 and 10 months old. So those are the animals that I'm buying in every year.
So you're running about a 1 year-ish to finish from the time you bring that stock in, and that stock is fully weaned when it comes in. That brings up a question I did not have planned. I have heard from many different sources, and I've even seen it bleed into the entertainment industry with like Yellowstone and stuff, that there is a severe risk of a dwindling of people doing the cow-calf part of this, and that eventually puts a pinch on the entire U.S. beef production model. Have you seen that? Is that being overblown? Is that because it's what they want, even though they're not getting it? Because, I mean, I know people around here doing it, and this is, well, it's Texas. Well, yeah, but it's also 25 minutes from Fort Worth. So we're not like way out in the boonies or anything. And there's people doing it on mid and small scale around me all the time. So I haven't seen it directly, but I've heard this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you've been following beef prices at all, they're at an all time high. It's pretty crazy what a 10 month old 600 pound calf costs these days versus just 5 years ago. And the reason that is the cow herd in the U.S. is at a 75 year low right now. So the normal cattle cycle, I would say, is probably a 10 year cycle where prices are low. So everybody liquidates their old cows. Well, then there's not as many calves. And then the price starts to rise. Well, when the price gets good, everybody keeps back all of their heifers so they can have cows and then, you know, sell those calves. So it's kind of a rolling 10 year cycle. But I would say we're kind of at a super cycle, if you will.
Okay.
So the cow herd is at a 75 year low. And the reason that is because we've had wildfires out west, down south. So guys haven't had the feed that they necessarily have had. There's been droughts, as you probably know, down by you.
Yeah, I know.
So when it's droughty, and they don't have feed to feed their cows, well, then they liquidate, you know, the 25% of their cow herd that's really old. So all of that has culminated into the smallest cow herd that we've had in a long time, but demand is still up for calves. So that's the reason calf prices are at an all time high. But, you're right. At some point there might be a real shortage of calves. And, you know, for my operation, I could never pencil out making it work, raising cow calf. And part of that reason is we're in prime corn and soybean country. So my land costs are much higher than somebody that's, you know, in rural Texas or rural Missouri or out west.
Yeah.
So my costs at the end of the day are much higher, which means, well, how do I become profitable? And that's by not doing cow and calf for us in particular.
Stuff I picked up when you were talking there that's interesting. One is that eventually you sold off a lot of this equipment. This is expensive equipment, even if it's 10, 15 years old. And obviously you can't sell it until you've transitioned far enough. But I think that's something that people that are considering doing what you've done can look at and say, hey, I do have this equipment that if I make this transition, eventually I'm not going to need all of it anymore. And they can actually use kind of in that final stage some of the proceeds from it to either backfill debt they had to take to do it or to move forward with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really smart angle that I really never considered because I haven't actually done it. I've just seen other people do it. Then the other one was you mentioned growing hay, and I was like, what a brilliant freaking thing to do. It's got a commodity market. You can always sell it. When conditions get bad, you sell it for more. And mm-hmm. if conditions get bad and you need some, you just hold some back and you have it for yourself. And so that just seems like one of the smartest parts of a transition you could do. Whatever you're growing for hay, you could conceivably, if you didn't harvest it all, graze it. You can harvest it for yourself and you can transition financially. I think that's it makes me think of when Mark Shepard talked about setting up his operation. It's different, but it's the same principle. You got to pay the bills while you're developing. And he mm-hmm. did alley cropping where, like, in between where he's growing all these trees that weren't going to produce anything for 3 to 6 years, he was growing, like, he said he picked so much organic zucchini he wanted to kill himself. But he said the reason I could keep doing it and not, you know, hang from the one tree that was actually growing by itself on the land and get rid of myself is because I knew it had an end.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew it had a purpose. It was going to a place. And I think that's something that people really need to think about is even if you're not transitioning, if you're going to buy land or lease land and move into this, you have to pay the bills along the way. And it's something that I say it a lot because of how many people are advocates for this type of thing, and it's great, but they've never done it, and they so oversimplify it. And you come from a farming family, so you know what would happen if somebody oversimplified something to your dad during his days he was in his prime. Right? It is not a conversation you want to have with a farmer, I promise you.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point there that most farms, grain farms, let me clarify, I mean, you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment that's tied up. And, you know, to pay for that equipment, you have to have a certain amount of acres to spread those costs over. Looking at our operation right now in our farm, the most expensive piece of equipment that is tied to the cattle would be an ATV. You know, the ATV is our modern day workhorse. Like that's what we bring our fencing out on. That's what we drag around our mineral feeder, our water sled. And so not having those huge overhead costs and just the maintenance on everything has been a huge, just a huge mind relief for me, not having to worry about all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the car and the truck are the horseless carriage and the ATV is the horseless horse.
Yeah.
Right. That's kind of what we've transitioned to. Like the ATV now serves the role for the rancher that the horse used to, at least for a lot of them. There's a lot of guys down here who are still doing business with horses.
Sure.
And there are, to be fair, there are some places that a horse can go and an ATV can't, but it ain't most of them.
Do you want me to, speaking of ATV, I'll kind of give you a breakdown of like our daily moves.
That'd be great. Yeah.
So like I said, we move our animals once a day. Everything we do is with Polywire. So just for a little context, our entire farm has high tensile woven wire, and then we have a top wire that's electrified. All of our interior paddocks or pastures are divided by a single strand of high tensile wire. So if you can imagine, you know, two strands of high tensile wire, and I'm grazing in between here.
Okay.
And we use poly wire and step-in posts, and that's what we're making our individual paddocks with each day, is with a poly wire. I've got miles and miles of above ground pipeline underneath our interior fences. And every 200 feet, I've got a quick coupler that I can plug into, kind of like an air chuck. And that's where we get our water from. So I've got a portable water trough that we drag with the herd. And then every 200 feet, I plug that into, and that's what fills up the water tank with a float.
Okay.
I've got a portable.
Was that previously for irrigation or?
Nope. So I knew I wanted to rotationally move animals. Well, the question is, if we don't have a pond or a creek, how do you get water? How do you get water to where the animals are without having to make them walk, you know, a mile back to the hydrant? So that's where I invested in above ground pipeline. So I've got a main feeder line that runs north and south on the farm. And then off of that, I've got branches every okay. couple hundred feet that branch off to those water lines. But having everything portable, I mean, that's the real magic in rotationally grazing, is that you constantly want to be moving your animal. So we're always moving them day after day. We never want them to be in the same spot for too long, because they're just going to eat the grass down and then regraze it before it's, you know, fully recovered. So our normal rotation is we're moving everything every day. We've got our mineral feeder. The one unique thing we do with our mineral feeder is I've got a cafeteria style mineral feeder.
Okay, cool.
Which has basically 16 different minerals in there. So I've got zinc, copper, selenium, baking soda, sea salt, you know, and a bunch of other minerals.
Mm-hmm.
And most conventional guys provide a mineral block, you know, one solid block that's got, let's say, all 16 minerals in that block. Well, the cool thing with a cow is she knows what she's deficient in. And the analogy that I tell people is, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night and you have a salt craving. Well, we go for the bag of potato chips or for some popcorn because we know, like, we just have that sense that we need salt. But a cow is really interesting that she knows if she's deficient in copper, for example, that, hey, I need some copper. So a conventional guy, they'll just have a single block out there. Well, that cow will start licking the block in order to get enough copper. Well, the problem is by the time she gets enough copper, she's overdosed herself on, you know, potassium or phosphorus or zinc. So by having all of our minerals individualized in single compartments, they'll go and they'll hammer the copper, let's say, for a week because they're not getting it in the grass. And then they might not touch it for 2 months.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a month later, they might hammer selenium for a week. And so that's really interesting to see is that they can pick and choose what they want.
And that they know. That's the big thing, that they absolutely know the thing that they need. It's like they crave what they need. And what I think a lot of people would hear that and like, okay, you're raising healthier cattle, so healthier beef. Mm-hmm. Yes. But what happens after a cow heats almost immediately? Comes out the other end. Well, it's actually a chain of things.
Yep.
But that means that the excess mineral is coming out and being deposited in a beautiful little patty that melts into the earth, right? And so what we're really doing, and then the other cow steps on it, and then, you know, you raise them through however many rotations it takes to get them back through a second time, we're remineralizing soil.
Yeah,
that
brings up
really happening.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, thanks to you, I really started learning about biochar maybe a year or two ago. And
oh, wow.
I was taking a grazing class probably a year ago, and the guy recommended feeding biochar to your cattle. So I started doing that about a year ago. And what I'll do is I've got a separate mineral feeder that I put straight biochar in, and then I'll mix just a tiny bit of white sugar just to kind of entice them.
Yeah.
But you're right. The, you know, the cow is licking that biochar and then it's going out the back end. And that's like perfect inoculated, you know, biochar that I'm slowly spreading throughout our entire farm.
And again, being worked in because all those big giant cows that work for free, right? Like, one guy wrote in, and I don't know how you would scale this to the size operation you have, let alone somebody that's doing, you know, 1,000 head or something. But he grows fodder for, he's running like 4 or 5 at a time. He grows these big flats of ryegrass. Mm-hmm. And the growth medium is biochar, and he just dumps a couple of flats out every day when he moves them. And so they're grabbing that fresh ryegrass fodder, basically, and they're just munching and of course the char's just going with it. But he's a small scale homesteader type. But like, there's all kinds of crazy ways people are doing this now. I see some operations are just basically making the big giant piles, and they're doing the top down, and then they put it out, and then grass grows up through it and all. When the cattle come through, they're smashing it just by walking on it, and they're eating it because they like it. It's really neat to see some of the ways people are doing this.
Yeah, I don't have the time to necessarily produce my own biochar, so I've been buying it in, you know, big totes, and then I've been feeding it that way. Long term, it would be really cool if I could produce my own, but that's a few years down the road. So at some point, you just have to buy the inputs in.
Let me ask you this. If somebody said they were making a poll for the least obnoxious, most useful government entity out there and asked me for a nomination, it would first make my neck twitch, and then I would think about it logically, and I'd say my nomination would probably be NRCS. From all the things I've talked to people about and all the people that from NRCS I've talked to, it's like they don't seem to cause any trouble, and they do seem to be at least somewhat useful. And they seem pretty small compared to the behemoths to govern. Were they of any assistance to you in this transition? Because it's right in their wheelhouse.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, thinking about government programs, I remember back when I was a kid, my dad talking a little bit about the programs that were available, and it always had kind of a negative connotation. You know, he didn't like to use them, but for a lot of grain guys, like that's like you're stuck in the system, and so you have to utilize them to some respect. So once we transitioned out of the grain side and, you know, fully into cattle here, I was just doing everything, you know, providing all of the infrastructure on my own, you know, with my own money. But I had a neighbor that was down the road that I was visiting with, and he mentioned to me one day, he goes, "Hey," he goes, "have you ever heard of NRCS?" And I was like, "No, tell me a little bit more." So he talked a little bit about NRCS and what they can do. And so I ended up going down to our county NRCS office and just had a conversation with them and said, "Hey, here's my operation. Here's my long-term goals. Here's my vision. Is there any way that, you know, what do you think? How can I potentially utilize, you know, you guys as a form of help?" And we were able to get kind of a game plan together as far as a grazing plan for our farm. We talked about some things that were available, such as fencing, you know, some cost share programs. I told them some of my resource concerns, that we had a lot of erosion on the farm. I didn't have any way to kind of rotationally graze the animals with, you know, fences and stuff, because I was building everything from the ground up. And so I was able to get some cost share for a few things, such as fencing, some water pipes, some seeding for some of the pastures. They were a really great help. You're right. I think they are probably the black sheep of the USDA in some respects, but most of those guys in the NRC office, like they want to help you as much as they can. You know, that grant or that cost share is earmarked for somebody. And, you know, when I look around and compare myself to where some of the money's going, it's like, man, I can do so much good for so many people, you know, and try to improve our farm. And so to use them, I was a little bit hesitant, but at the end of the day, it was a good move to bring them kind of in as an advisor and helped me learn things that I didn't necessarily, you know what to do. So,
yeah, what I like about them is they kind of do take that consultative approach. Like, here's what you could do, and if you do that, then here's the things that come with it that we can do for you. But they're not a agency that mandates things until you agree to them. In other words, they can come in and recommend all kinds of shit, and you can go, you know what, I don't want to do anything like that. And, okay, bye. Right? That is not your typical. Like, they are not the people that Reagan had in mind when he said the most horrifying words are, "I'm from the government here to help you." They black sheep is a good term. They're just not in the same mold. And I think it's because of what they're mandated to do. Like, their mission would be impossible to do from a standard government format. You can't go out and make people do the things that they're encouraging. In fact, I almost feel like some gremlin, a positive gremlin, invented them. Some nefarious little renegade rebel goblin inside the government's like, I know what I can do, and got away with it, is kind of how I feel with that group. Moving on to the next thing, like, I've always said, producing is hard. Moving the product is harder. It's the place where a lot of people, like people that are giant grain farmers, there's a, if you grow a whole bunch of soybeans, even if you have a bad year, even if, as long as they're not bad, if like maybe not the super highest quality, there's a place to just go and you get money for it. You might lose your ass, but you can move it. Is you do things like this, like there's the sale barn model, but it's probably not the best. There's a straight come on. How do you find customers? Are you finding ways to get more money for a cow that you produce as a meat animal than, let's say, somebody that just, you know, ships them all off to a wholesaler?
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking back to growing up, I didn't know the finances necessarily of my parents, but I knew that things were tight. Like, you could just get that sense as a kid that, you know, we have food on the table, but money was tight. And so growing up, having that sense of what I had growing up, looking forward, once I became an adult, you know, I was in tune with the fact that whatever I'm going to do, it has to be profitable, you know, and I don't want to just barely scrape by. So that's kind of early on when I realized, you know what, I have to do the direct to consumer model, where I'm producing the best quality beef that I can, and I need to sell this directly to the consumer, because partially I wanted that customer relationship with people. You know, when you're growing grain, you're shipping it to the local elevator, and then it's gone. You never know what happens to it.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Yeah.
Who cares if you raise the best corn possible? Like, it's just going to a faceless consumer and then it's gone. So, you know, thinking about, well, what business model do I want to pursue? That's where the direct to business, you know, direct to consumer model kind of was at the forefront of what I wanted to do. And I was, a few weeks ago, I was reading, your book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I was in the intro, and you had a quote in there that says, create the job that you want for yourself. And that was exactly what I did, 10 years ago. Was I knew, hey, I don't want to grow conventional commodities. I don't want to do conventional commodity beef, because if I'm going to do this, I want to raise the best, most nutritious, most nutrient dense meat that I can.
Yeah.
And, so that was the model that, you know, that I started with and kind of built up from there. And the other thing that, you know, early on I kind of thought about was like, okay, if I'm raising this beef and I want to sell it directly to consumers, well, how am I going to get it to consumers? So you got a couple options. Either the consumer comes to you or you ship it to the consumer. And it was at that point I did kind of what you said, like I created the job that I wanted for myself. And with a young family, I knew that adding another layer of trying to ship frozen meat around the country was a huge world that I wasn't ready to dive into. So the model that I created was, well, I deliver the beef to the local butcher, and then the customer picks it up directly from the local butcher, and they're able to customize everything that they want. So they can customize the steak thickness,
yep,
their ground beef, you know, leanness, the packages they want. They can get all of the bones, the fat, the organ meat back. So yeah, in a nutshell, that's kind of how I started.
You know, I think it's a great way. It's what I do. I got a guy down the road from me that does this, and a lot of years I don't have a problem buying the whole cow. I don't have room for it, even with all the freezers I have, because I have this meat, this freezer flow every year that peaks right about November when 80 people show up here.
Mm-hmm.
And it just happens to kind of coincide in a lot of ways with when cows are ready to graduate, and at least his are. And so I'll often split one with another one of his customers, and we'll both get a half beef that way. And that's worked out a couple times to where, like the stuff you said about organ meats and bones and all, the guy I'm splitting with doesn't want it. So I'm getting all of the stuff like that from his side of the cow too.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, like you said, it's really great. Like he'll take him down there. We've already paid him at that point, or actually we pay him right after he takes him there, because we pay on the hanging weight is how he does it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pay the processing fee separately to the butcher, but it, you know, they'll hang it for a couple weeks to age it. And then the guy that runs that place will call me and run through the cut sheet with me of what I want. And I think that's fantastic, because if you're trying to sell like retail case type cuts, a guy like me walks through and goes, those are too thin, right? I want my steaks like 1.25 inches thick, maybe my wife's 1 inch. Right, because that way I can cook them the same amount of time and get both the doneness we want. She eats less than me, you know. And then somebody else walks and looks through steak that was cut for me, and they go, "That's too thick," right? Or I wanted the cap on my ribeye. I wanted the cap taken off and made into that Colette steak or something. Like that gives the consumer total control over the product delivery. Let's say the packaging. It's not right the word for it, the cut. And it also circumvents some bureaucratic bullshit too. That's another nice thing about it. And I'm thinking, like, the guy that I buy from and you probably both read Joel Salatin's books, and that's a big part of like his whole model, at least it was early on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of what we do is bulk beef. So quarters, half, you know, whole beef that I'm delivering directly to the local butcher here. And then customers can customize everything, you know, that they want. And a lot of our customers are first time customers, and I tell them I'm here as a resource. So I provide instructions for them. I kind of give an overview of how the whole process works. Like you said, the 2 week hanging weight and then what they can expect, and just kind of walk them through the whole process. And if they have questions along the way, I'm definitely here for them. I do sell some smaller beef boxes directly here off of the farm, whether it's a 20-pound, 30-pound, 40-pound box. But that's a small percentage of what I do, because long-term, I definitely try to steer people. Hey, you're going to get the most value by buying in bulk. You can customize everything based on what your family wants, and you can get all of the bones, organs, fat back, and, you know, really, really take advantage of the whole animal.
Awesome, man. You take Bitcoin as payment. How did that start? Did Texas Slim have anything to do with that? Or
yeah, Texas Slim definitely did. I heard him. I think you interviewed him. Oh man, maybe
3 years ago.
Six. It's been many years ago.
Yeah.
And as you know, he's an energetic guy, and that kind of at the time I didn't know much about Bitcoin, and after, I would say, learning more about Bitcoin and understanding it and then educating myself, it just made sense that, man, I should start accepting this, because there are a percentage of people that want to pay in Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it's not a huge percentage. I would say maybe like 1-2% of people want to pay me in Bitcoin. But yeah, after listening to Texas Slim, he definitely kind of put a burr under my saddle to figure this all out, as well as, you know, listening to you and learning more about Bitcoin. So yeah, it's a small percentage of what we do, but long-term, I think it's great.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want 100% anyway. You need a certain amount of cash flow to pay bills, suppliers, employees, contractors, and by feed and whatever. And my goal, and I've yet to consistently hit it, is 5 to 10% of revenue in Bitcoin. That's a kind of about a perfect amount, because pretty much if it comes in as Bitcoin, it freezes. It doesn't go anywhere. And so I start getting more complex tax situations. If let's say 40, 50% of my revenue was in Bitcoin, I could live on half my income, but not the lifestyle that I want. So I would have to be bringing it in and converting it if I was, you know, in that range. So 1 to 2%, that's fine, because that's like the way I look at it, it's like an additive to my retirement plan. Mm-hmm. That's just money that it's complicated to spend, and there's tax paperwork I don't want to do. It becomes an asset that you grab onto and hold. And I really dig that. And I think it also gets me business. I'm sure it does for you too, that you may not have gotten otherwise. Because I got a lot of Bitcoin. There's people, especially people who've been in this a while. Yeah, there's a bunch of it over there. And I can buy a cow a year with Bitcoin or whatever. This guy sells cattle. This guy sells cattle. They're both great, but this guy's a Bitcoiner. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna kind of keep it in the family that way.
Yeah, I've had a handful of people that have found me on Texas Slim's Beef Initiative website. I was just on there a couple weeks ago and I was listed, but I went on today and for some reason their website's kind of wonky today. I've had many people that have found me specifically because they wanted to buy beef with Bitcoin. So it's definitely been an asset, you know, to be advertising that fact.
Yeah. What are the biggest challenges in building that direct to consumer business, you know, and from scratch? One of the things might be, I would think, is that when I look at where you live, your population density is probably a lot lower than mine. You got people have to travel to get the product. You know, how far are you from like major markets? Was there anything else?
Yeah, I would say the biggest challenge was definitely the marketing side of things. I'm able to mechanically, you know, figure things out, whether it's building fence, putting water pipe in, grazing cattle. But the biggest question is, well, how do you get your message to the consumer at the end of the day? Like, that's the biggest challenge is getting your name out there. So, over the years, that's definitely been a learning curve for me. And the one thing that really helped was a couple years ago, I ended up taking a Farm Rebel marketing class, and that was a really, I guess, eye-opening experience for me. Like, it really helped me to create the marketing side of the business. And currently I do a newsletter that I email out to my customer list every couple of weeks. I do a little bit of Google ads out there. I haven't really got into social media too much. I do have a social media presence, but it's just another thing at the end of the day that I don't necessarily want to do, but I should do. But definitely the marketing side was the biggest part of it. But early on, being able to be honest with people and just explain, you know, our story to people and explain, hey, our goal is to produce the best quality grass-fed beef from our family farm that we can. And people really appreciated that honesty and just the transparency we have with not hiding, you know, what we're doing. And that's definitely led to repeat customers. You know, one person's really happy with their beef, well, then they tell five of their neighbors and their friends. Sure. So our customer base has definitely grown over the years because of those repeat customers.
And I mean, you're only going to scale so big anyway. With your land, you're only going to have a certain density of herd. So if you can lock in over time, maybe 50, 60% of your business from repeat customers, you're in really good shape for what you have to bring in as new business every year. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to turn around 5 years from now and be like, man, we got to sell 5,000 cows. The land doesn't have the capacity. So at some point, if you do decide you want to be bigger than you are, you either have to buy more property or lease more property. But you probably make a pretty good living off the number of animals that you're raising if you get it dialed in just right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my goal long term, was what can I pass on to my kids that would be a viable business? The grain side of things, I didn't see a future in that, just because of all of the inputs, all of the equipment, and the land base that you need. The reality is most grain farmers these days, you have to probably be farming 1,000 acres and have $1 million or $2 million worth of equipment to make it a viable business. And, you know, with land costs really high and all of the inputs, that wasn't the direction, you know, I wanted to go. So like you said in the past, you know, I was thinking of that seventh generation thinking, like what do I want to do that I can potentially pass on to my kids and keep this farm going? You know, it'll be their option if they want to continue it on, but at least it is an option for them, is to have, you know, a viable business that they can continue on.
Have your children been involved with a lot of this, and, you know, like doing the 4-H thing, raising pigs? How do you see family integration fitting into all these things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been great having our kids involved here at the farm. So we originally lived off of the farm, a couple miles down the road, off of the farm, and then in 2017 we ended up building a house here at the farm. And yeah, it's been great being able to have our whole family here. We've been homeschooling our kids since COVID happened, and we've continued to do that, and that's been great, because every day I'll take one of them out and we'll do chores together. So we kind of have a rotation. So one of them will come out every day and they'll help do chores. So whether that's moving the fence, moving the waters, rotating our animals, we'll move our herd up into the corral every month or two, and we weigh everybody just so we have an idea of how they're gaining out on the pasture. As far as other things, you mentioned the pigs. So last summer, I twisted my kids' arms and said, "Hey, we're going to get some pigs, because I think it would be a good summer project for you." So I sat down with our kids, and they're between 10 and 15 years old. And, mostly I sat down with our daughter, who's the oldest, and I said, "Hey, here's what I'm thinking of doing. I'm thinking of getting 6 pigs. So let's sit down and let's talk about, you know, how do you run a small business? 'Cause this is going to be your operation for the summer." So we sat down and we got an Excel spreadsheet out. We talked about, okay, we have to buy the pigs for this much. We're estimating this much feed. You know, how much labor are you going to have to do on a daily basis? And then we had a rough idea of what those pigs would cost. And then we got them, we actually got them last May, and then we butchered them last November. So, you know, we had 5 or 6 months where they were rotating them through the woods on a daily basis, or not daily basis, a weekly basis, but they were doing, you know, all the chores, each and every day. We kept track of their labor, how much feed we were giving. So that was just a great real world, you know, experience for them to look at, okay, here's how you run a business. You've got expenses. And then we knew, okay, we can't sell these pigs for any less than this amount, because we have to at least break even. So, we made a profit on that, and we were able to sell them through our customer base. And, I think this year we're going to scale up a little bit and, do it again. So it's just been great, you know, to have them involved on a daily basis and be able to be out in the land, be out in the pasture, explain things, get their decision making skills going. And I tell them a lot. I said, "We're not raising kids, we're raising adults here." So and they kind of roll their eyes a little bit, but they're definitely benefiting.
It's absolutely true too. And that's an old one that I started hitting on. Like, we're not raising children, we're raising adults. If you raise children when you're finished, you have really big kids. If you raise adults, you have well-adjusted young adults ready to enter society. And it's one of those things that people say, "Well, that's just what people say." And you've read my book, so you know how I feel about what people just say. You're programming your mind, you're programming your brain, you're setting expectations. And I don't think anybody really wants to raise an adult child. Mm. It just doesn't. People are doing it. That's why some of these people live in a freaking basement until they're freaking 35. But that's not the goal, right? The goal should be that every day that kid is a little closer to the finish line of becoming an adult. And it's hard sometimes because you kind of want them to stay little. They're fun when they're little, you know, and I'm dealing with some like second transition syndrome here now with a 15-year-old and a 9-year-old, you know, grandchild. And 15-year-old's really distancing himself. And I'm learning because we never had a daughter that girls do it earlier. That whole distancing thing, and you're creepy grandpa and you don't want to be seen around their friends or whatever, you know, and you're embarrassing because you talk to somebody. It's kind of crazy, but that is what we need to be doing. Is they're going to go through that period of transition themselves. And it's good that they do, because, you know, you want someone that's out there, maybe can take care of you when you're old instead of somebody you're still taking care of when you're old. And that's how you do that. It's just the right thing to do. But, You have a, let me pull this up. You set up a page for people in this audience. Let me see here. I got it now. Let me change over to this. And, it's pretty cool. You've got a bulk, a guide for buying, bulk beef, available for people. You want to tell people about that?
Yeah. So for some reason on yours, it's not showing up the guide. There should be a form there. I know Safari, I just checked it this morning.
Okay.
But anyway, there's a sign up there on this page where people can sign up.
Browser compatibility, JavaScript issue or something.
Yeah. Chrome was working as of this morning, and so was Safari. So could be cached maybe. I kind of created this page there should be a sign up form there where people can sign up if they want a bulk beef guide. It's in that,
it's there. I've got it on it. I can't put it on the screen cause it's in a different browser, but I've got it in Safari and it works. That's odd. Okay, it's odd cause it's Firefox. I'll take a look at it.
Sure.
When we're done, and anything I learn, I'll let you know about it. Or maybe Tom can look at it. And it's probably something to do with the fact that I don't let certain things happen. Sure. In my normal browsing. Anyway, go ahead.
Yep. So yeah, we've got a bulk beef guide there that people want to learn more about bulk beef and how that works. They can sign up there. I've got a welcome video that kind of describes our farm for people. I like to compare and contrast, you know, our beef versus conventional beef. So there's a chart down there. People can go on the website and check things out as well. Normally I would say, because we don't ship beef, our average customer lives somewhere near Northern Illinois. So anywhere between 2 to 3 hours from Northern Illinois would be most of our customer base is in, you know, whether it's the Chicago area, Madison area, Rockford area, there are where most of our customers are located. Hope that helps.
Very cool. And I'll make sure that we have a bunch of stuff here for folks. We have the TSB dedicated page on the bulk beef buying guide. We have Facebook page, Instagram page, some other stuff. I'll make sure that every bit of that ends up in the show notes for people. And if you're watching a video down there in the video notes, there's some text and some links to a bunch of things. But the first link you'll see will take you over to the audio version of this podcast. If you click it right now, you're not going to get anything because we're not done yet. So if we're live, it's not there yet. Once the live ends, it'll take about 30 to 40 minutes for my slow ass to get it up on the other side of things. And before we let you go, can we go ahead and hit some questions here for you and me both, probably, in some comments. I just thought this was a great comment because I was thinking the same kind of thing when you were telling the early story of your family and growing up and dealing with hardships and how everybody came together. Hey, Alabama just said, when life gives you lemon, make lemonade. I can't imagine growing, what a wonderful family he had growing up. And I think we weren't farmers, you know, we were coal miners and such, but the things you were talking about, that's how family used to be in America, pretty much everywhere. And now it's only left in a few pockets. And I think we need to bring more of that back. So you can say something on that if you want to. It's not really a question.
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, my parents had a great influence on me for sure. They were definitely, you know, there to guide me, mold me, learned a ton from my dad. So yeah, family's important for sure.
Jesse says, how did you do your pipe crossings?
So I've got hydrants from the north side of the farm all the way to the south side. I buried a 1 1/4 inch line that's 4 feet deep. And every 600 feet, I have a hydrant. And then off of those hydrants, I run an above ground pipeline that goes horizontal. So if the main feeder line's this way, this is every 300 or 600 feet, I've got a horizontal line with the quick couplers.
Okay.
And it's that a one inch HDPE with a Job quick coupler.
Okay. Ekamau, who has many questions apparently. Does Stephen Bash use permaculture methods similar to Jeff or Salatin's recommendation of running chickens 72 hours after moving cattle? I'm going to bet no.
So we've raised chickens just for our family. Like we've had broilers before and layers, but we don't have the chicken coops like Joel has.
Yeah.
But, you know, long term, there's tons of enterprises you could stack, you know, in the operation for sure. It's just, do you have the time and the manpower and the energy to do it all?
Joel can do what he does because he has these people called woofers, and because he's written like 5,000 books, he's got like an army of them that show up new every year.
Yeah.
That model sounds great, and it is great if you can pull it off, but I don't know if people can even get their head around the number of chickens you would be talking about on an operation your size, which is kind of a small mid-size operation, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's a lot of chickens to do. What they're talking about is that leader follower system. And I think it's a cool idea, but you have to look at the ROI when you do anything. Whenever you add something to a business, if you can't grow the infrastructure of the business, which includes the human capital in it, to absorb the new thing, then you have to take away from something else because you're probably not sitting around with 8 hours a day to work and you're, you know, 12 hours a day to work and you got an extra six on your hands. That's when you add enterprises, when you don't like, hey, I'm just sitting around half the time and ain't got nothing to do. If you're not in that mode and you start running chickens, now you've got to take time away from the cattle, and the cattle have what's called a high ARPU. That's average revenue per user, right? So when you sell a cow, it's a big, if you sell a quarter cow, it's a pretty sizable transaction.
Mm.
And it's probably easier to sell a half a cow than one chicken to some people. chicken's so commoditized. You know, because here's one of the things I've noticed I think is good for people like you. I go to the grocery store now, and you know, they have a little section of grass-fed beef, which probably isn't, but that's what they say it is, and organic and all that. And there was always a really big premium on it. It's not a premium anymore. I don't even know why people are buying the CAFO beef at this point, because the premium stuff costs maybe $1 a pound more, where it used to be like a 50%, 40% bump to that level. So I think that's even more case for doing this, because if I'm doing chickens and I've got a $20 pasture raised chicken, I'm competing with an $8 roaster from Kroger. And we both know why, but the consumer brain doesn't make the connection. But if they're buying beef and they're getting better for about the same, or maybe depending on how you do it, even a little bit less, if you work it all out to buy it in bulk, well, then you don't have to deal with that. And because I've been to farmers markets and watch a farmer try to explain why their chicken's $18, $22, something like that, and just watch the person's brain. Just it won't take it in. I like the method, but the delivery is the key. Eek also says, does Stephen grind the biochar and feed them? He's talking about the cattle. Would inoculating it before help them? Does biochar get a filter in their system, or is it just inert? I can probably take some of that for you. You don't have to do shit because it's a cow. It weighs 1,000 fucking pounds and it takes care of the problem for you and inoculates it when it goes out the back end, and it does help absorb toxins. But do you have anything to add to that?
So I'm buying all of our biochar already pre-ground in bulk totes. So
oh, okay.
It's it's fairly fine already. And then I try to feed about 80 grams per head per day is kind of my ratio that I'm looking to do. But when they're ingesting it, the benefits that I've seen is that I think it helps to tie up some of that excess protein in the springtime, because with grass fed beef, there's a potential for it to have a gamey flavor. Uh-huh. And over the years, I've kind of learned a little bit that gamey flavor is tied to high protein. Mm. Well, the question is, well, when do you get high protein in their diet? And definitely in the springtime when the grass is growing really fast, let's just say from May through June, the protein's really high. And if you're feeding a high alfalfa, you know, over the wintertime, that's like a 20% protein. So by feeding biochar, it's able to tie up some of that excess protein, so it's not floating around in their blood, creating that gamey flavor. So that's one thing. And then, you know, having to go through their system, you're inoculating it in their system.
Yeah.
And you're ultimately improving the ground because it's going out the back end.
Like, especially since you're buffet mineral feeding on top of that.
Yeah.
That's the most premium cow patty to come out. And I would imagine, like, when you get high protein too high a protein in your grass, the cow patty is more of a cow squirt than you'd prefer. And maybe you get a little less of that with the biochar.
Yeah. The squirting out the back end, that I would say that's more tied to the amount of fiber.
Okay.
That's in the plant. So in the springtime right now, you're going to have high protein and low fiber because the grass is just growing so fast. So I feed the biochar to help with the protein problem, but then I'll free choice like oat straw or wheat straw to help them to have more fiber in their diet. So it's amazing. I can put a whole bale of wheat straw out there and they're eating fresh grass, you know, just gobbling it up.
Yeah.
But then they're going and they're hammering that wheat straw because they know that they need fiber in their diet. Otherwise they're going to be squirting out the back end. So it's amazing how they were created for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that's what people say, well, the dog ate grass. So it's like, no, the dog ate grass cause it knows what's doing. Leave it alone. Right. If it's munching down on it or something, then something's wrong. But if your dog or your cat eats a little bit of grass here and there, they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Eek is asking if you use a CSA. That's really not your model, is it?
Mm-mm.
No. If you went the greenhouse route and you're probably happy you didn't, that's more in that, like, that varied box of stuff every week or whatever during the growing season. Nurse Wang, I'm moving to Tennessee and I want to start a small ranch. Where to start along this process? I want the end start small. I think he means I want to start small and grow naturally over time.
Yeah, I would say the advice I would give him is invest in yourself first. So, you know, when I say that, I read tons of books, tons of articles, networked with others. I ended up going to an Acres conference, which was south of me a couple hundred miles, and just rubbed shoulders and elbows with other guys that were there. I made sure, hey, give me your phone number because I'm going to give you a call because I have questions. And so, you know, just invest in yourself as much as you can. But at some point, you have to take that knowledge and you just have to start, you know, and you have to know that I'm going to make mistakes and hopefully they're not expensive mistakes, but start, you know, start small. And then, at some point, you just got to do it.
Yeah, dude. I'd also say try to find someone doing it successfully. And if you can get them to let you come, just pay attention to what they're doing, maybe do some free work for them.
Yeah.
And be sure you want to do it. There's a lot of things that are really, really rewarding and you can have a great life doing them, but they're not for everybody. And those are all the things. All the things are right for somebody and not right for somebody else, right? There's things I don't want to do. I could do them really well and I could make money doing them, but I don't want to do them. And I think that in a world like ranching and farming, you should figure out what you want to do. Like you said earlier, I said, design the job you want. So start with the end in mind. What do you want your day to be like? And then don't romanticize something that's not romantic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're not delivering calves anymore, but you know, shoving your hand into a cow up to your armpit and pulling a baby out is not exactly romantic and entertaining and life empowering. But for some people it is, right? Somebody like, I help give life to this animal or whatever. So know what you're getting into in any situation would be my kicker to that one. Last one from Eek. Has Steven considered adding a flyer for buying a freezer with their purchase, or maybe an affiliation with a sponsor? I'm not sure exactly how that would work out for you, but I do. There is a guy around here, and he figured out kind of like what was the minimum size freezer that you could stuff a half beef into. And he literally advertised you could get your half beef for this much or with a freezer delivered for that much. And what he did, I talked to him. He said he talked to all his customers first and said, and potential customers, like, do you need a freezer to be able to do this? And if you said yes, and he said, well, if I brought it with the beef, what's it worth to you? How much would you be willing to pay? Went out and found like a base model that would fit about that price, and then cut a deal with, if I buy more than X amount. And then that way, if he didn't get enough people that wanted it, he could still break even on the few he had to pick up. Mm-hmm. And eventually he said he got a ton of customers because it solved a problem in their head that wasn't really a big problem. Because you can do the same thing for yourself with a point click buy on Home Depot. It'll show up. They'll even plug it in for you. But there was something about it like being like, hey, here's your meat and your freezer. And people did it. That was kind of crazy. But I don't know if I would. I'm not in the appliance business, is how I feel.
Yeah, there's lots of different marketing things you can do, and I've seen the offers for, hey, if you buy a half a beef, we'll throw in a freezer. It's something I've considered for sure. Where we're at, we're able to sell 100% of what we raise.
And so don't do anything else.
Yeah, so at this point, it doesn't make sense for us to pursue that.
I get that sometimes with like a class or something. They say, why don't you do a discount or whatever? Because it's sold out in 5 minutes.
Sure.
Why would I discount a product that sells out in 5 minutes? It doesn't make any. Why would I discount something when I'm already selling 100% of my inventory? I went after a guy that was doing some really cool apple cultivars for MSB that way. And when he was like, him and Han, I'm like, what's the deal? Like, it's extra business. He said, I sell 100% of what we produce every year. I said, then don't talk to me. He goes, I'm not being a dick. I said, no, I'm being serious. I'm not offended. I wouldn't do it either. I would be like, hey, we don't need to sell any more than we have. And I told him, I said, if you ever end up with a surplus problem and where your production exceeds your capacity, tag me in and I'll help you. But I mean, that's a big thing that most people that run businesses need to understand. When you get to the point where you're selling all you can produce or make, that's where you raise your price. You don't discount crap and you don't add anything unless you're adding profit. Like, mm-hmm. if you could come up with a way that you could source freezers for $200, you're into a market that would buy some $300 freezers. And now that's additional revenue, where what she was coming at it was more how to sell more cows. And mm-hmm. that might be beneficial when you're getting started, but in the beginning, she says she's got a small deep freezer she bought with 100 pounds of beef when stationed in Fort Hood 26 years ago. You got a good freezer, Eek. Don't ever let that freezer go. I've got a freezer that is probably almost as old as me. I don't even remember where I got it from, and it's still just trucking away out in that garage, and we get 100-plus days, and I've had new freezers make it 4 years. You get one of them old freezers that I bet the one at my dad's place is still working. And I don't know when that thing was made, but just remember what it looks like. I'm thinking late 30s. And it just doesn't care. Anyway, man, hey, I appreciate you being here, sharing what you're doing with everybody. Again, he's got that guide for you folks. He's got his website, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. Check the audio notes in about, if you're listening right now live, give me 40 minutes. Everybody else, if it's after the fact, it's already there for you. If you're watching a video on one of the platforms like Facebook or YouTube or X or what have you. Hey, Steven, thanks for being with us today.
All right, Jack. This has been great. I appreciate it. Thanks for all you do.
All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed today's show. I keep trying always to bring you as much diverse content as possible. You know, this week we talked about on Monday artificial intelligence. Then on yesterday we talked about disease-resistant vegetable varieties, and today we're talking about kind of a mob-grazing grass-fed system and how a farmer can transition from grain to that. So I think the diversity of content has been hit well this week, and I hope it's appreciated. Tomorrow, of course, we have an expert council show. That'll bring a ton more things. We'll be talking probably dogs and diet and all kinds of cool stuff. But if you like the work that we do and you want to make sure we're always here, there's a couple ways you can do that. One is become a member of the Members Brigade. If you do that, you'll get discounts on things that you're probably buying anyway. I just brought a brand new, exceptional discount vendor into MSB. I'm going to tell you who it is tomorrow because guest shows always go a little bit long and I can give it more approach. But if you're an MSB member, you can log in. I bet you can figure out who it is. And it's already some badass pricing on some cool stuff with a pretty good discount saddled on top of it. They are also a brand new sponsor. So if you go to the survivalpodcast.com and look at the banner stack, you should be able to really quick figure out who it is because you've never heard about them on the air before. So we got that coming for you. Anyway, my point with the discount vendors is if you become a member of my programs, $50 a year, and you will get enough discounts if you use them to more than pay for it. So essentially it becomes free to you. You get better deals on stuff. You find vendors in our community that care about the same things that you do, and we all win that way. Most people, I think, that use their membership, they make more money than it costs them. They make a profit on it. So please consider becoming a member. Just go to survivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. The other way, do your online shopping at tspaz.com. This is completely painless. It costs you no real money because you're going to buy the same thing you're going to buy anyway. But you also can find all the things I recommend. My item of the day today is the Olatin's T58 folding scalpel. I love these things. This is one of the few things that I ever found on one of the stupid little influencer videos, and I'm like, that looks pretty cool, and it was. The one that was in the influencer video really wasn't, but the concept was there. So I went on this deep dive to find like the best titanium folding EDC scalpel type tools I could. Olatin's was at the top of the stack. This is the one I like the most because it's large enough in its blade length at 2.75 inches to actually function like a small pocket knife. This is the largest standard surgical blade that's made. It is good for all the cutting things. It's not a heavy working knife. It's about having that razor blade sharpness all the time. And when it gets dull, you pop it out, you stick a new one in that costs pennies a blade. And there's also a smaller form factor one. The body, the spring, all of it's made out of titanium, so it'll last forever. I've been carrying this now for a couple of years. I love it. Everybody that's got one loves it. I've sold out literally thousands of them, and I've never had a complaint yet about them. So check these out. You can find it at tspaz.com. Again, that's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com, or just go to survivalpodcast.com, and you start scrolling down. You'll see stuff reviewed. But if you go to T-Spaz, you'll see all the other ways that you can shop and help us out. It doesn't cost you anything. I got tons of stuff reviewed there. If I say it's good because it means I spent my money on it. I bought it. I used it. I liked it. I didn't get angry about it, and I would buy it again. So you can take that integrity with those endorsements that way and make good decisions for yourself. And with that, I'm going to say goodbye to you. Thank you for tuning in today, and I will catch you tomorrow with Expert Panel Show. Remember, that is not going to be a live stream because of the way those shows work. It goes out on the audio side only. So if you only catch me on YouTube and what have you, get on over to my site, subscribe with whatever podcast app you use. We're on Spotify. We're on Apple. We're on Pocket Cast. We're on ones I don't even know about. We're on all the value for value with Bitcoin, Fountain, and that stuff too. So we are available anywhere and everywhere. And if you're on YouTube for the first time, please give us a like and hit that subscribe. And if you don't give us a like, you're going to get bit by the Eco Mouse. Check out the live chat if you want to know what that's all about. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with that expert panel show. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
revolution.